Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I guess everybody knows that Elvis Presley is called the king of rock and roll, but probably a lot fewer people know that the father of rock and roll is a guy named Chuck Berry. And if you've ever heard his records or especially seen video of his performances, you'll know why. Every great rocker and rock guitarist, from Eric Clapton to Keith Richards to Paul McCartney to Bruce Springsteen, readily acknowledges that they took their early inspiration from Chuck Berry. He basically invented rock guitar, and he had an onstage style so energetic and so unique that it was electrifying, which is the essence of rock and roll. My guest today has devoted much of his professional life to telling the story of Chuck Berry. Some years back, he wrote a biography called Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, The Life and Hard Times of Chuck Berry, which was the basis for a PBS special on Chuck Berry's life back in, I think, in early 2020. If you missed that, you have another chance, since a new one-hour documentary on the life and times of Chuck Berry aired as part of the In Their Own Words series on PBS. My guest is Bruce Pegg, a New York-based writer and editor who's basically the authority on Chuck Berry's life. Welcome, Bruce.
Well, thanks for having me, Court.
Nice to have you on. So you're not a music critic or a professional rock journalist, I don't think, Bruce. How did you get so deeply involved in telling the story of Chuck Berry's life?
Well, it's an interesting story. My background originally was as a musician. I've played as a solo act and in bands for many years. In addition to that, from a lot of my professional life, I was in the academic world. I taught writing and English at various institutions in upstate New York. And there was a time, I can't quite remember the exact year, but one very boring Friday afternoon when nobody was in my office and I had a few minutes to myself, I, for some reason, started to look into what had been written about Chuck Berry. And the answer was stunning. Very little had actually ever been written about it. And if you think about it, Court, you talked about Elvis Presley at the beginning of the show. You know, there's been volumes upon volumes written about him. Buddy Holly has had a number of biographies written about him, even though his entire musical career from his first hit to his death in 1959 was only 18 months long. And I thought that was a real injustice to the man that really created, as you said earlier, the guitar vocabulary that so many people following him used, not to mention the, you know, the great songs and the visual appeal that his live act had. And at that point, I said, you know what, Bruce, you are just as capable as anybody of writing this book. And 6 years later, it was published, as you said, as Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, the Life and Hard Times of Chuck Berry.
That is surprising. Yeah, that was a real gap that you discovered.
Absolutely.
There. Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I mean, you know, I don't think it was because he was black, because there are a lot of great black musicians about whom a lot has been written, but it's funny. Anyway, so I'm glad you discovered that gap and filled it and are still filling it today. So since we're talking about Chuck Berry's life in large part, why don't you give us a thumbnail version of his early life and how he got started playing music?
Sure. So Chuck was born in 1926 in St. Louis, Missouri. And one of the most immediate things that struck me as I was working on the book is how important his geographical background was to his life and his career. He was born and raised in an area of St. Louis called the Ville. And the Ville was one of the few areas in St. Louis where black families, black people could own property. Very segregated community, but a community that learned to rely on itself within a short, I think it was about a 6x8 block area. Chuck could go to the theater, he could go to a beauty salon and have his hair cut. In fact, he later on in life was a hairdresser himself. So this one area was a great lesson for him in the whole idea of self-reliance. And I believe that as he went on in life, particularly when he finally settled on a career in music, he understood that in order to basically function and survive as a musician, he had to learn all the facets of the business and had to rely on himself because he couldn't trust anybody else to act in his self-interests.
Yeah, so I guess that he was lucky in a sense in growing up in that little enclave, that little island of sort of black stability and prosperity in the middle of a sea of white city.
That's right.
And there were a lot of places like that around the country at the time, but he was lucky to have benefited, I think, from the stability that a place like that would bring him, and still he got inspired. I mean, the style he developed, I think, has been described as a blend of country music, which is back then was called hillbilly music, and rhythm and blues. You know, he wasn't too far from Tennessee, where there was a lot of country music, and you know, it has a hard charging quality that he would pull out of his guitar. That was one of the unique things, was this like driving, you know, just mm-hmm. this driving feel out of his guitar that had, you know, conveyed all that energy and power. And really, you know, Bruce, we can't do a radio show about Chuck Berry without playing at least one clip. So I'm going to play just the first minute of his song Carol from 1958. Listen to the guitar. Wow, that was something. So I think you see what I mean. I mean, that's nice 1958. Stuff. That's not 1968, right? Mm-hmm. So I gather, too, Bruce, that Chuck Berry's family, although, you know, relatively poor and not really well-educated, still read a lot, especially poetry, and that influenced his songwriting. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would agree with your assessment that they weren't well-educated. Chuck's mother was a qualified English teacher, and I think that's where he got a lot of his interest in literature. In fact, Chuck's youngest brother was named Paul Lawrence Dunbar Berry after the famous African-American, turn-of-the-century African-American poet who wrote a very influential poem called The Mask. Mm-hmm. And so, his family played a huge part, too, in his musical upbringing. His father was a deacon at the Antioch Baptist Church, which was just around the street, around the corner from where they lived. And his sister Lucy was a fully trained mezzo-soprano, classically trained. So, he was just steeped in this whole tradition of classical music, of American Black Baptist music, and poetry. So I think the ingredients were there right from the very earliest parts of his life for what he was to become.
Wow, I wasn't just a little wrong about that. I was really wrong about that. His family was very well educated. So he came from, you know, a cultured background, really, which is funny when you listen to the country funk, you know, kind of lyrics, you know,
That's
and
right.
all that. But so, but he was very fortunate in that way then to have had that influence from an early age.
And it's, interesting enough, his father, who was not highly educated, I think his father was a contractor who worked a lot in the neighborhood and got a lot of work both in and out of the neighborhood, actually.
Yeah.
And I think that was where Chuck got his work ethic from, because, you know, people think of Chuck as a star, as a rock and roll star. You know, my take on Chuck is that he felt that music was just a career. It was just a vocation. It was something you did to earn money. And, I don't think he ever regarded himself as anything special, even though anybody that knows anything about the history of rock and roll will tell you how incredibly influential he was.
Yeah. Well, he may not have considered himself an artist, as everyone who's involved in any of the arts today considers themselves.
Yeah.
But he was, and you can hear it in all his lyrics. I mean, they're clever and they flow. I mean, I'm gonna read the lyrics to one of his biggest hit songs called Johnny Be Good, and I'm not gonna sing it to everyone's relief, but I'll try to read it in a kind of a sing-songy way, because part of the poetry of it is the musicality of it, you know. So let me start with Johnny Be Good. Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood. Where lived a country boy named Johnny Be Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ring and a bell. How am I doing so far?
I think you're singing it great.
All right, so, and then it goes on with a repetitive chorus, which is, go, 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 Johnny, go. I'm not going to read all that, but he used to carry his guitar in a gunny sack, go sit beneath the tree by the railroad track. Oh, the engineer would see him sitting in the shade, strumming with the rhythm that the drivers made. The people passing by, they would stop and say, oh my, but that little country boy could play. Go, 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 Johnny, go. And then on with another chorus. And then third verse and last verse is, His mother told him, someday you will be a man, and you will be the leader of a big old band. Many people coming from miles around to hear you play your music when the sun go down. Maybe someday your name will be in lights, saying, Johnny be good tonight. Go, go. So, I mean, you can hear how catchy that is. And, you know, once you hear it a few times, you kind of, you know, like a lot of great songs, it's hard to get out of your mind. It gets to be a worm in your brain. So.
Yeah, this is obviously the most well-known song he ever wrote, and I think it's a great example of how he approached songwriting. You know, you think in the court about the details that he includes in the song, you know, carrying his guitar in a gunny sack. That was so typical of Chuck, that his attention to detail and also the rhythmic quality. I mean, you know, as you just found out, it's almost impossible to say those lyrics without falling into that cadence, into that rhythm. And, you know, every word contributes to that quality. And it's, just a masterpiece of songwriting. So great, in fact, that Carl Sagan included that song on the golden disc that was on board the Voyager spacecraft. That is probably one of the first things that an alien civilization will ever hear of humanity on Earth. And they're, you know, alongside Beethoven and Bach and Mozart. So it's a tremendous testimony to how great that song is and how much of a symbol of rock and roll it has become.
You know, another aspect of it, too, is that it tells a story, and all of his songs do. I mean, if you listen to Maybelline, which I'm not going to read, but, but you know, as soon as you start hearing it, you instantly visualize the situation. You know, it's very easy to just imaginatively put yourself in the position of what he's talking about. And so it tells a story, and that's another key element of his songwriting that was new at the time and that became a hallmark of rock and roll from then on, you know.
It was huge. He didn't initiate that idea in rock music. I think that goes back to his love for Louis Jordan, who preceded him and who wrote those great story songs like Caledonia and Saturday Night Fish Fry. But the ability to be able to, within a 2.5-3 minute portion of time, to be able to tell that complete story from start to finish is just, you know, an incredible ability that he had.
Yeah, and again, it's poetry. I mean, you know, it's not just that it rhymes, but that the cadence of the words and the choice of words makes it just flow like water down a stream. You know?
It's not just about, you know, I want to hold your hand or, moon and June and spoon. There's so much more depth to it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he grew up, as we said, in St. Louis in the Jim Crow era, and even though Missouri, where he wasn't in the Deep South, segregation was definitely in force. And in the film, they mentioned something that happened at the Fox Theater in downtown St. Louis when he was a young kid.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment, and it's one that, as I was writing the book, I was searching for a good way to open it, and I landed on this particular incident. In 1986, they held a 60th birthday anniversary show for Chuck at the Fox Theater in St. Louis, and there's a moving scene in the movie Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, which is the documentary that was made about the concert, where Chuck stands outside the box office and tells the story of how his father wanted to bring his family to go see the movie Tale of Two Cities, which was first premiered in 1935. And so he marched his kids downtown to the Fox Theater, which in those days was probably the grandest of all the theaters in St. Louis, only to be turned away from the box office because they didn't sell tickets to black patrons. And at the point in Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll, after Chuck tells that story, he then turns around, walks in through the front doors of the Fox Theater and walks towards the auditorium. And all of a sudden, we realize that this is where he's now going to be playing to celebrate 60 years of his life and all the great music that he had brought into the world.
Mm. Yeah. Turned away and then to return as the conquering hero.
That's
pretty amazing story.
Yeah, it truly is.
Did being black and discriminated against in those days, I mean, he was born in 1926, right? So,
correct.
You know, we're talking about the mid-50s when he's just starting up in his meteoric rise. Did being discriminated against influence his writing and playing very much?
In so many ways, Court. I mean, we could probably spend hours talking about that, but let me give you a few examples. Chuck tells numerous stories about various incidents on the road where he would be chased out of town by white members of the audience. Chuck, as a black musician, found it hard, even after he first started, to get work if he portrayed himself as being black. So he talks in his autobiography about how he would consciously adopt a more white style of singing. He certainly doesn't sound like any of the blues shouters like Big Joe Turner, for example, on any of his recordings. So there was a conscious attempt right at the beginning of his career for him to try and not exactly pass as white, but certainly not pass himself off as black either. He was a photographer, a keen photographer, who knew how to develop photographs in his darkroom, and by underexposing them a little bit, he could actually make his publicity photos look like he was a little bit whiter than he actually was. And very often he would show up for a show, and the promoter would be very angry because he thought he'd booked a white act, only to find out he'd booked a black one. And, Chuck was often ripped off on the road and was just really at the mercy of the white establishment. You know, a lot of the black performers in those days were tricked out of a lot of the money that they were owed for recording. And particularly, you know, the acts would go in and they would record a song. They would get paid a scale, a set fee for going in and recording, which very few acts would do these days. And not only that, but they would also get a fraction of a percentage of a penny even if the song became a hit. But very few acts understood the value of the publishing royalties, which was really where is and still is where the money really lies in music. And Chuck was one of the very first musicians of his era to take charge of his own publishing. Very shortly into his career, about 3 years into his career, when his first contract with Chess Records and ARC Music Publishing, which was the publishing arm of the Chess organization, when that first contract came up for renewal, he opted to start his own publishing company, Chumpberry Music, which then became Isolee Music, and took charge of his own publishing, which was really led to the wealth that he was able to accumulate later in his life.
Yeah. Well, as you said, I think at the beginning he viewed it as a career, as a business, more than just, I'm going to play music because it feels good and I love to hear it or whatever.
That's right.
Like
right.
The audiences, maybe he liked that, but he also very much liked music. We'll talk about that in a minute, I think. But it took courage to start his own company, because that alone was kind of a revolutionary move. I read that one trick that the producers, the white producers and managers would play would be to pay the performers or the artists a small amount to give them, the producers and managers, the songwriting credits, which then would direct the royalties to them, and they would then toss, $10 here and $20 there to the artist if they needed to make rent or something, and just basically cut them out of their own cash flow due to their work.
Absolutely. And in fact, Chuck's very first hit record, Maybelline, which you mentioned earlier, was initially credited to him, to Alan Freed, who was the New York disc jockey, that basically for a rather large sum of money, which we don't know, that was paid by the Chess Records, Phil and Leonard Chess. Freed basically got a cut of the song for exposing it on his radio show, and another gentleman named Russ Fratto, who we still really don't know exactly who he was, but we suspect the Chess Brothers had some business dealings with him. But all three of those people were credited for a song that only Chuck wrote. So that's a good example of how a lot of artists, not just black artists, but a lot of artists were cheated out of the royalties back in the day.
Yeah, I think it also, I read that it drove him toward performing because he could control the money right then and there in performing, and it wasn't some business thing where checks are being written and you never saw the check,
That's absolutely right. And in fact, Chuck very quickly did two things. Number one, he started his own booking agency. In other words, you had to go directly to Chuck to book him for a show rather than going through a talent agency or something like that. And the second thing he did was operated under a business model where he practically cash only, or you would pay him a certain amount of money as a down payment and he would receive the rest in cash. And that got him into a lot of trouble later on in his career.
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Well, you're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Bruce Pegg, who is a writer and an author, particularly an authority on the life of Chuck Berry, the great rock musician who we called the father of rock and roll, and who most great rock and rollers acknowledge as the father of rock and roll. So we're talking about his performance qualities here, and one of his signature moves was what he called, I guess, the duck walk. And this is radio, and we can't show it, but look for it on YouTube, and you know, watch the movie, and you can see it, and you'll see what it was. It's like a bent over, long legged hoochie coochie kind of across the stage with a guitar between his legs and playing like crazy.
That stuff was
just not done before, you know, and people just stood there like woodenly playing for the most part, and that kind of thing drove audiences wild. And
absolutely.
I wonder if it influenced Michael Jackson's moonwalk or the way that Jimi Hendrix sometimes played. What do you think?
It would not surprise me. Chuck actually was not the originator of that kind of thing.
Was that right?
He actually got a lot of his guitar playing technique and visual technique from T-Bone Walker. And T-Bone was known for, you know, a lot of antics on stage with the guitar playing behind his head, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay.
But Chuck probably did originate the duck walk. He talks in his autobiography about discovering it by chance when he was a child, trying to retrieve a bowl or something from underneath the family's dining room table. And his mother saw him and thought it was so funny, she asked him to do it again. And I guess he claims that that was when he learned how to do that. And, of course, it became such a signature move. I mean, Angus Young of AC/DC years later would copy it. And a lot of musicians, a lot of guitar players do it as well. But yeah, I'm sure it was some form of an influence on a lot of the acts that followed him, including probably Michael Jackson and Jimi Hendrix. I mean, you know, a lot of people knew Chuck, and you know, I like to talk of him as the triple threat, because unlike Elvis, who was a tremendous performer in and of his own right and a great musician, you know, Chuck was able to write his own songs. He was able to do his own shows, and was a tremendous guitar player as well. So I mean, those three elements alone should ensure his legacy in the music world.
Yeah, I mean, really, you can boil down all we've been saying to the fact that he was a smart man with a strong will and a strong personality, and he managed to break out of the system of control that controlled really most performing musicians, but especially black musicians. And he just burst out of that and somehow succeeded and managed to do it without being killed or something. But
yeah,
but he apparently didn't, as far as I could tell, do drugs or alcohol, which was very unusual for a performer and still would be unusual for performers. But he had some weaknesses that counterbalanced that. And he loved women in particular, especially young ones, and they loved him, and it got him in trouble. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so the first time Chuck got into trouble was in 1959, when he met a young Apache Indian woman while on a tour of the South, and brought her back to St. Louis to work at a nightclub that he owned at the time called Club Bandstand. And it turned out that even though the woman had told him that she was 18, she was in fact 14 years old. And that led to Chuck being convicted of a violation of what was then the Mann Act, which was basically a white slavery sex trafficking act that had been introduced into the 1920s. And due to the ambiguous nature of the way that the act was worded, basically anybody that crossed state lines with a member of the opposite sex could be convicted of that. And Chuck fell foul of the FBI at that point, and was eventually sentenced, I think, to 5 years, but only served about 20 something odd months of that sentence. So yeah, and I think that was a defining moment in his life. I think, you know, we talked about how he took control of his own affairs, and I think that was the moment when he finally said, that's the only way I want to go at this point. And a lot of people said that he came out of prison after that experience very much changed, and became a lot harder and a lot more cynical and bitter about the world. And basically, at that point, if you knew Chuck and he liked you, you could enter into his world. And if he didn't, he kept you at arm's length and viewed you as being hostile. So it was a very defining moment in his life.
Yeah, but paradoxically, he was married for his whole adult life to a woman he met when he was 21, and I think she was about 20. He called her Toddy, and it was basically a lifelong love story. But, you know, as we're saying, he was also a serious lifelong womanizer. So just in a nutshell, we're kind of getting toward the end of the show here, Bruce, but why do you think she put up with it?
Well, that's a great question, and nobody really knows the answer to that, Court. But I think really a lot of it was Chuck always came home to her, and he provided her a really comfortable life, and he was loyal to her in his own way. So I think that was what that was all about.
And I guess it was a different time when you know, she kind of viewed it as, you know, you get married for better or worse, and as long as he treated her well and and the life they had together when he was there was good, then maybe she just turned a blind eye to it. I think that happened a lot. So we mentioned that by the time he did take control of the business side of his career, he was really starting to get rich, and he was very much into money. So like women, though, that also got him in trouble. What happened there, just briefly?
Well, in 1973 or thereabouts, he did lots of financial dealings that came back to hurt him later. First of all, he did a number of shows called the Rock and Roll Revivals with a New York promoter named Ralph Nader. And on a lot of those shows, he would sign a contract that stipulated he got paid union scale for the show, which was like about $200 for each performance. But in reality, he pocketed over $10,000 for the shows in cash, which was never declared. And then later he did the same thing on a British tour around that time. And then eventually the IRS, as they do, caught up with him. And in 1979, he was imprisoned for tax evasion. So, he was certainly, he certainly understood the value of a buck and tried to hide it as best he could.
Yeah. So he was a man of contradictions. I mean, he was, he was larger than life, and he was both good and bad in extreme ways, I guess. But, so I guess, you know, would you agree that he was a man of contradictions? And
absolutely. And in fact, one of the things that struck me as I was writing the book is that there were two Chuck Berrys. There was Charles Berry, who was his people that were close to him, his family, his friends would refer to him as Charles. And then there was Chuck Berry, the performer, the person that basically could get away with anything. And I think that his whole life had that kind of not schizophrenic, but certainly dual aspects to it.
Yeah, you talked earlier, Bruce, about in 1986 when he headlined that really it was a sold-out concert at the Fox Theater where he'd been turned away as a child decades earlier. And I mean, this thing was, you know, a mega performance. It was backed up by Eric Clapton and Keith Richards and Robert Cray and Etta James and Julian Lennon. And, you know, it was a star-studded performance, and he was out front, you know, and they were all basically his sidemen. And so, you know, in the end, what do you think drove him? I mean, obviously it was... He wanted money. He wanted to never be poor again. But was there a self-worth aspect to it? I mean, what really drove him psychologically, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. And I think ultimately, I think, as I said earlier, he viewed himself as a journeyman, as somebody that was particularly good at a certain skill. And that was a means to an end. He certainly never viewed himself as being anything special in terms of his public persona. And I think that was really him. I don't think if he needed affirmation, maybe that was through his love for women. But certainly he rarely felt the need for affirmation as a musician and a songwriter. And in fact, you know, rarely granted interviews and would very often walk out on interviews if he didn't feel they were going the way that he wanted them to. So that, you know, that's my take on Chuck. I think he was just I think he pretty much was a humble guy in certain aspects, and in other aspects, he was, like you said, a bundle of contradictions.
Well, Bruce, this has been very interesting. We're going to have to leave it there. But to watch the documentary we talked about, go to pbs.org and search for In Their Own Words, and you'll see the episode on Chuck Berry. And Bruce, I want to thank you so much for being on with us here on American Variety.
Oh, Court, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Yep, and thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.